What was the shocking result of this week's Greenland election, and how will it affect the Donald Trump's plans to grab the land for America? Why is Trump so intent on getting Greenland one way or another that he would contemplate military force if necessary? Is the new foreign policy agenda for America taking Greenland, the Panama Canal, and even Canada a return to the imperialist policies of the 19th century? Is the collapse of the American economy being managed to the advantage not of the American people, but of the American wealthy? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we focus on the differences in American foreign policy resulting from the newly sworn-in President Donald Trump and how it is changing not only international wars, but even the alliances within the world order. In our first half hour, author and journalist Ron Redenour reports on the recent Greenland election and how the result was reflected and impacted by the promise of the American president's annexation threat. Then, in our second half hour, frequent Global Research News Hour commentator Jack Rasmus reflects on the reasons for Trump's approach of making threats to allies and meeting with supposed enemies all in the name of building peace in our world and making America strong again. On this week's program, Restructuring of Empire Part 4, New Trump Approach to Greenland, Panama, Canada, Ukraine, and Beyond. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 14th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States, and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We acknowledge that the land was stolen from the indigenous people who were here first through broken treaties, false promises, and the doctrine of discovery, and the necessity of making amends for and paying reparations to acknowledge our responsibility today for the harms done over the last two centuries. May we begin the process of healing and restoring mutual respect for both indigenous people and the settlers in the days and years ahead. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 8-0 in NAACP v. Claiborne Hardware Company in 1982, that nonviolent boycotts are a form of political speech which are entitled to First Amendment protection. The problem, unfortunately, when you're dealing with a president who believes that he can do whatever he wants because he is the law, is that anyone and anything can become a target. Mahmoud is the test case. As journalists Gabe Kaminsky, Madeline Rowley, and Maya Sulkin point out, Mahmoud's arrest for being a, quote, threat to the foreign policy and national security interests of the United States, unquote, note he is not actually accused of breaking any laws, is being used as a blueprint for other arrests to come. What this means is that anyone who dares to disagree with the government and its foreign policy and express that disagreement could be considered a threat to the country's, quote, national security interests, unquote. That comes from the article, When Dissent Becomes a Crime, The War on Political Speech Begins, by John W. Whitehead and Nisha Whitehead, posted March 13th, originally published on the Rutherford Institute. And finally, the most decisive factor might be that Putin truly believes that Trump is serious about, quote, escalating to de-escalate, unquote, in which case he might prefer not to risk a Cuban-like brinksmanship crisis that could hypothetically end with Russia compromising on much more than if it agreed to a ceasefire. Putin is a pragmatist who prefers managing tensions instead of exacerbating them, with the only recent exception being the decision to use the Oreshniks, as explained here, so he might take Trump up on this. Everyone will soon find out whether or not Putin agrees to a ceasefire, but whichever decision he makes, the five reasons that were shared for each scenario would compellingly explain his choice. It's anyone's guess what he'll do, since each scenario's arguments are persuasive, and he knows that this is his most fateful decision since the special operation. Putin might therefore ask their respective Kremlin proponents to debate amongst themselves in front of him one last time before making up his mind. That comes from the article, "Will Putin Agree to a Ceasefire?" by Andrew Karibko, posted March 13th, originally published on the author's Substack. Such high tariffs and other causes paved the way for the worst economic depression ever seen until then, the Panic of 1893, which lingered on until 1897. It had been preceded by an increase in the cost of living for most Americans, balance of payments deficits, bank runs, a credit crunch, a stock market crash, business bankruptcies, and a 25% unemployment rate. It would be a tragedy if such a failed economic experiment were to be repeated more than a century later in an economic and financial environment that could be more sensitive to disturbing political shocks. Everything would seem to be in place for the United States to enter into a perfect storm with a convergence of several crises, political, economic, financial, and constitutional crises. Most of those crises are purely man-made. That comes from the article, Turmoil in the USA. Great inequalities, corruption, over-indebtedness, speculation, division, and imperialism. By Professor Rodrigue Tremblay, posted March 13th, originally published on the author's blog site, Dr. Rodrigue Tremblay. And now that the Atlantic superpower is really signing its intent on pivoting to the Pacific, partially withdrawing from Eastern Europe and shifting NATO's burden onto its European allies, there is weeping and gnashing of teeth amongst Europe and Britain's political elites. European powers today are simply not what they once were. Consider the United Kingdom, for instance. It might even lack the capacity to maintain its own nuclear arsenal without American help, as experts have been warning in the context of Trump's, quote, burden shift, unquote, threats to, quote, unquote, abandon or to leave the American transatlantic allies on their own. In January last, a British, quote, unquote, Trident nuclear missile embarrassingly failed for the second time during a test launch, which led to speculations about the realities of Britain's nuclear deterrence. Long story short, Paris and London are the only nuclear powers in Europe, and it is unclear, however, to what extent they would be capable of replacing the so-called American, quote, nuclear umbrella, unquote. That comes from the article, Much Ado About Nothing, Macron Proposed Nuclear Umbrella for Europe, by Uriel Araujo, posted March 12th, originally published on InfoBricks. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Greenland has a new prime minister after the elections of March 11th. Joining us now to discuss this result at a time when Donald Trump's promise to access the province one way or another, we're joined by Ron Ridenour. Ron Ridenour is a US-born author and journalist. He has been an anti-war and civil rights activist since 1961. He now lives in Denmark and, in addition to writing a dozen books, has served as a special correspondent and freelance investigative journalist for many publications in the US and several Latin American and European countries, among them. And he is a guest, past guest of the Global Research NewsHour. And he has been tracking the results of the Greenland election and joins us now. It's a pleasure having you back on the Global Research NewsHour, Mr. Ridenour. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be here again.
Now, Greenland has delivered the most votes in their proportional system government to center-right Democratic Party, led by Jens Frederik Nielsen, meaning he will have a shot at forming the next government in coalition with another party. It was an opposition party. How different do you expect this will be from the previous government?
Yeah, well, that's a big question which I cannot answer in an expert way. I think that among other reasons as to why this is an historical election is because he did win for the Democrat Party, which has never been in office before. I mean, have never been in the government before. His party doubled in a half its previous members of the parliament from what, 4 to 10, and overthrew the two parties coalition that are the traditional two parties that win, one or the other being the leader. That is to say, the what's called the left wing Inuit Party, the United Inuit Party, which calls itself a Democratic Socialist Party, and the other party, Siumut, which is the traditional Social Democratic Party associated with the Social Democratic Party in Denmark. But both of those parties, although they're called left wing, have quite a long ago abandoned anything socialistic. The Inuit Party has, without stating that it has abandoned it, has sanctioned privatizing companies that were cooperatively owned. But they both these parties are have become, so traditional. I mean, so much in power that they've lost contact with much of the voting population. This Democrat Party and a couple of other, another one called the Mac Le Roc Party, when English Breakpoint, they have been smaller parties and closer to local people with local problems. So a lot of the people that came out this time, and as you said, the greater numbers than ever before, but that's only 70% of the people who are eligible that in fact did vote. But it is more than otherwise, and many of them came out for local issues. Like there's a, as throughout Scandinavia and Europe as a whole, in the last 20 years, there's less and less funding for welfare programs for the traditional social security system, and more money going to wars and more profits for corporation. So I think people, from what I've read and the little bit that I can gather from some interviews and some voters' comments, it seems like they just got tired of that lack of concern and lack of contact with people in the communities. Then, of course, there's the Trump issue of wanting to buy it or in some way or another take Greenland from Denmark. That has been positive in the sense that it's made people wake up to the fact that they have been colonized, and now it's an issue that the international media will talk about. Denmark has treated the people, Inuit people, up to the Newfoundlands, since Erik the Red, the Norwegian Viking that occupied some of Newfoundland and then Greenland and also Iceland. And they were very vicious, brutal colonizers. They didn't colonize very actually, but they just came in and took over for a while. The colony actually started in 1700. And in the course of all this time, the suppression of the people, the treatment of them in a racist way, which the United Nations has codified just 2 years ago in 23, is irritating the people more and more, and they want to distance themselves from Denmark and have be independent, but they're dependent upon the block subsidy, the block grant that the Denmark gives them to be kind of a colony with home rule now since 2009. So half of their income comes from Denmark, and that pays for the social system, the workers in schools and hospitals and so forth and so on. And then the rest of their money comes from exporting fish. So from what I understand, the people don't want to be a part of any colony any longer. They don't want to be a sophisticated colony of Denmark, and they don't want to be a state in the United States. And the biggest reason is because the welfare system that still exists, although less than it was, is much better than what exists in the United States. And even people who support Trump, and there are a few, one man is well known for being what's called Trump's son, Trump's Greenland son, and he's visited Trump in some victories in the last year or so. But even he does not want to be a part of the United States. He and others want greater contact, more closer economic contact, and then the whole question of minerals, is are the minerals going to be exploited? So what we have is a surprise upturn of the traditional so-called left parties, replaced now by a center-right, very pro-business party. The leader, Jens Nielsen, is known for being a badminton champion, and his party is associated with the Denmark's Liberal Alliance Party, which is a, basically a libertarian party. So whoever he chooses, and he has basically two choices, one being this former left-wing party, the Inuit Union Party, and the other one being the party called Breakpoint, which is also a conservative party. They want a referendum as quickly as possible for independence. The Democrat Party is willing to go in that direction, but wants to go slower. So now I've talked for quite a while. This is the overall, this is the overall situation. And of course, oh yes, we must mention that the Arctic area, the geopolitical military area now, there's more and more military coming in already from Denmark to Greenland to as a response to Trump's, accusation that they don't protect Greenland. So they're sending a couple of ships and helicopters and more surveillance and whipping up an hysteria that Russia is going to invade yet another European country. And
Could you
this, of
talk?
course, is a major issue in throughout all of Europe.
Okay, could you talk about how if this I mean the party which came out on top favors a more go slow approach to independence, as I understand it. So not
Yes.
in a hurry to get out of Denmark's grip. Was
Right.
this the best or worst possible outcome from Trump's perspective, do you think?
What would be the worst or best?
Yeah.
Well, I don't see the any. There's no expression. Even with the so-called Trump son, he didn't want to be a state of the United States because they have still a welfare system, and they recognize that the United States, doesn't treat its people very well. But they would be willing to, sell minerals. I mean, they already have started a they have legislation from 2 years ago that allows selling of some rights for minerals to foreign investors. So I think probably some deal will be made regarding that. The United States will continue to be the major, they have this political, they have this, military base that has been called Thule Base. Now they've changed the name to a more difficult name called Pituffik. But the Pituffik were a people, an Inuit people that lived there. And when the Yankees came in already in the Second World War, they just threw the people away, like they do in most other places that are the so-called global South, even when it's the global North. And so they took over an area which they built this base, and they had atomic weapons, and four of them sank in the sea in 1968 in an accident. The Greenlanders are in a situation like other people in strategic areas that can't really master their own future because of the international conflicts between warring factions. The United States always needs some enemy, and Russia has been their enemy. Now, Trump may want to change that and maybe have just maybe China as an enemy. But so far, the reaction within Greenlanders themselves is that we don't want to be a part of Denmark, of neither Denmark or the Soviet or in United States, but we have to find out how we can be economically self-sufficient or take care of ourselves. The Arctic area is, of course, part of it is where China is and where Russia is, and the Europeans now want to be more hawkish than even the Trump regime wants to be. So we have these international conflicts there, and yet the people of Greenland are not wanting to be victimized by it. They're not wanting to take sides. They want just to be Greenlanders.
Greenland is a self-ruling colony under Denmark, and Denmark has a proven a record of higher than average loyalty to the United States among European states, as a couple of your articles have indicated. And I'm wondering if, all the threats against Greenland, and taking it over or annexing in some way, were they uttered in his various past speeches actually directed at Denmark in some way, because it's currently under their protection, so to speak.
Well, Trump, when he came into office in 2019, the current state prime minister of Denmark, Mette Frederiksen, a so-called social democrat, had just come to power, and he was invited to come to Denmark, and at that point he said, "Well, I'd like to buy Greenland." He's a big businessman, and why not? I mean, it's closer to the United States actually than it is to Denmark. And as I said, Denmark, the U.S. has basically occupied and dominated Greenland militarily since World War II, and they'll continue to do so regardless of whatever the Greenlanders or the Danish people want. She said to him, she's the word absurd. And of course, Trump got all huffy and puffy about being called absurd, and he canceled the trip. But they met later that year in London at a NATO meeting, and they came out of it smiling, and Mette Frederiksen said, "We swing well together." She came back to Denmark and started expediting and increasing the amount of weaponry, of the money for welfare going more to weaponry, and doubling the amount of funds for NATO. And then since the war in Ukraine, they've doubled that even more, and just the other month they now want to triple that. I mean, we're talking about an increase of from 1.5% of the GNP for NATO to triple that within a 3-year period, a 4-year period. I mean, it's absurd. Plus, the Yankees are going to come with weaponry and troops and occupy three bases, military bases in Denmark, which has never happened before. And as I wrote, you mentioned recently a series called Scandinavian, The World's Happiest People Love Killing for the USA. And every year there's an organizations that figure out who think that they are the happiest people, and the Danes and the Finns and the Swedes and the Norwegians always are number one to number five. And like the Israelis are number five this year, and yet they love killing, and the Israelis are killing Palestinians, every day since 1948. And the Scandinavians are doing this, and especially Denmark, since 1991, in every one of the wars that Clinton or Obama or Bush number two or Harris they want. So they feel especially chagrined, smacked in the face, like you're just a little colony. We don't need you anymore. Feeling that they're having because Trump w doesn't want to prioritize Europe. He's thinking globally and is not wanting to be burdened down by his colonies in Europe. And those colonies have been willing colonies, and now all of a sudden they don't know, where to go. So their recent reactions are to be even more warmongering than the United States at this point.
Ron Ridenour, I want to thank you for all this interesting post-election analysis. I gotta end it there, but I'm afraid. But thank you very much for your time.
Yes, you're welcome.
Ron Ridenour is a U.S.-born author and journalist, and now living in Denmark. And he joined us this week from Spain. Behind Donald Trump's mesmerizing new approach to international geopolitics. Jack Rasmus has presented on this subject recently in a series of episodes of his show Alternative Visions. He calls it a restructuring of the empire. So we invited him on the show to speak to listeners about what it means for the present and the future. Jack Rasmus, as you know by now, holds a PhD in political economy and is host for the radio show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network, a journalist, a playwright, and a former professor of economics at St. Mary's College. Jack Rasmus joins us after this brief break. Don't go away. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Good afternoon, Dr. Rasmus. Pleasure having you back on the Global Research News Hour.
I'm glad to join you.
Greenland and the Panama Canal were threatened with annexation, possibly with military force, by Trump. Is America turning back to the 19th century Monroe Doctrine imperial conquest, or are they making nightmare threats to get a less harsh goal?
No, the empire is consolidating. Restructuring. We've had these periodic restructurings of the American empire for over a century now. World War I was the first, as the U.S., after it finished its first imperial foray offshore the continent with the Spanish-American War, 1898-1903, you know, that war was funded by taxing property owners, and it didn't go over very well. And the U.S. Imperialists knew that, you know, if they were going to participate in a conflict in Europe, which was imminent by 1912, that they would have to restructure. They could not participate in that, and nor could the U.S. Empire, now beginning to economically move offshore, really play with the European empires if it did not have a position in terms of its currency and its military. So what happened in World War I was we created a central bank, the Federal Reserve, which was really dominated and run by the New York banks. That's why the New York Fed to this day handles all the international transactions and the currency issues, you see. It's kind of like the central bank within the central bank. We created a new fiscal system based upon the income tax and the corporate income tax, which, by the way, taxed mostly the rich. The working class was not covered because they weren't making enough money by the income tax in 1916-17. So we had a new fiscal monetary policy. And after World War I, of course, the U.S. dollar became the co-currency along with the British pound, and the U.S. stepped onto the global stage. Well, another restructuring occurred with World War II. And in that one, obviously, the dollar became and the U.S. became the hegemonic economy and country in the world. The Brits and the French had to pretty much sign over their empires to the U.S. They kept vestiges of it and then lost that. And we had a new monetary policy and a new fiscal policy, a new industrial policy, and a new external policy. So every time you have a restructuring, it's usually related to the empire either expanding its role, participating, or the third restructuring, which followed in the wake of the collapse, economic crisis of the 1970s, economic and political. Third restructuring has been called neoliberalism. Occurred late 70s, early 80s, and expanded in various ways throughout it. We had a new mix of fiscal, monetary, industrial, external policies that enabled the U.S. empire to expand once again. It was really a class-based policy, neoliberalism, and it was about taming its capitalist challengers, which were Japan and Europe at the time, and weakening its non-capitalist challenger, the Soviet Union. It proved to be successful. It also was successful in attacking working class and their unions in the U.S. and the social movements and so forth. So it was very successful imperial policy. That's how you need to understand neoliberalism. You know, neoliberalism, I've always said, is kind of an obfuscating term. It's really about imperialism and class-based politics. So that neoliberalism succeeded for several decades. But then the contradictions, as I argue in my new book, began to intensify in the 21st century. And since the 2008 crash and then the 2020 crash and in between slow growth, what we've had is a increasing inability of the neoliberal policies to deliver for the empire. And what we have today is the empire as it's structured here in the neoliberal period is unaffordable. They've got to restructure it with the purpose of reducing the cost or moving the costs to areas of the empire that are considered more fundamental and more strategic. The U.S. has decided, at least this wing under Trump, has decided that The Ukraine war at $350 billion is a waste of money. The trillions of dollars thrown into the Middle East with the war against terrorism and certain countries hasn't produced significant results. And NATO is a waste of money. NATO doesn't need, we don't need to keep providing a security umbrella to Europe. And that's what Trump keeps saying. He says, pay your own way. I mean, you know, you're rich enough. Why are we paying your way? Well, we're paying their way so they can maintain these nice social program and benefits for their population because they don't have to fund a defense. Now, of course, they're trying to realize they have to do that now. And what we're going to see in Europe is funding warfare at the expense of welfare. That's coming. And even their media is talking about that, Financial Times and others. So that's in progress not right now. We can return to that topic. But what it means is that the U.S. is cutting its costs, you know, whether it's NATO, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's the 800 bases around the world, whether it's USAID and NED and all the other wasted expenditures, which are part of the empire. And it's looking back into the Western Hemisphere and saying, well, you know, we've got to shore up our strategic homeland here, which is North America, Western Hemisphere. And that's how you got to understand Greenland and the Panama Canal, you see. This isn't crazy Trump. This is very conscious policy. They know what they're doing here. What they're doing in Greenland is America's trying to develop an Arctic strategy. It's way behind the curve with Russia's Arctic strategy, which is well developed. The U.S. virtually has no Arctic strategy, even though it has Greenland at the western side of its Arctic. Alaska. It wants Greenland at the eastern side, right? And then, of course, it's got to somehow get the northern Canadian territories in shape here for that Arctic strategy. Because as the Arctic clearly is the ice cap is disappearing, it's opening up a transition, a pathway for Russia and especially China to Europe. That's a strategic estuary or whatever you want to call it there on the western side of Greenland. So the U.S. wants to consolidate that. An Arctic strategy, control, basically prevent the flow of Chinese commercial shipping through that that pathway there. And there are rare earths in Greenland that they want to exploit. Panama is similar. Panama is about checking China. You see, China has been buying up properties and deepening its influence within the Panamanian government. And the U.S. is no, no, no. And it's already taken moves, put pressure on the Panamanian government, which has cut a number of projects, economic projects with China as a result. Also, the Panama Canal needs to be enlarged significantly, and Panama doesn't have the money and doesn't want to, do the enlargement. Why? Because the new Ford class U.S. aircraft carriers can't make it through the canal as it exists. So it's strategic in that sense. And in the latest development, BlackRock recently just bought up the ports on both sides of the Panama Canal is the beginning of this. And the Panamanian government is backing down and talking about, more U.S. control and influence of the canal itself. So both the canal and Greenland are part of long-term strategic moves to check Russia and to check China. And that's how it should be seen. And to talk about the 51st state of Canada is really to put pressure on Canada, I think, to really go along with the developing of a Northern Arctic strategy, and also as a way of Trump raising funds through tariffs in order to also help fund the restructuring of the empire. You see, it's not just saving foreign aid and foreign adventures and unnecessary expenditures abroad, but it's also the tariffs. The primary objective, there's two objectives of tariffs, Trump's tariffs. One is to politically browbeat allies and whomever for political objectives. Like in Mexico, it's all about really the immigration and fentanyl flows and so forth. And it works. It works. So, well, we saw the same thing with Panama. It works because Trump found in his first term, even though his trade strategy failed to check China, it did raise significant revenues. And Biden continued those revenues, by the way. And Trump sees revenues as a key way of reducing the debt and the budget deficit by raising revenues, but also as a way of moving the expenditure cuts, whether they're in Europe or wherever, or whether you raise money, to move that money into new weapons investments. You see, the U.S. is way behind China and even Russia in drone technology and in hypersonics and ballistic missiles and so forth, and AI and so forth. Well, it's pretty much in a big competition with China for AI. But there's a lot of crash weapons programs that need to be funded. And the empire is structured cannot fund it now because it's throwing away all hundreds of billions of dollars every year, in places that aren't strategic to U.S. interest anymore. Ukraine is not strategic to U.S. interest. And even, conflict with Russia is not strategic, Russia per se. The big challenge to the empire is the BRICS and the global South, which is really the most serious challenge, I think, to the empire. Certainly even more so than both Japan and Europe and Soviet Union during the 80s. The global South in the 80s was a non-entity. It was undeveloped, it was pretty much exposed to whatever pressures the U.S. wanted to put on it, economic or political. Well, that's not the case today. The global South is industrialized. It's a major player in the world now, and it's the future major player. The BRICS could undermine the dollar and the currency and the international payment system and so forth. I think the Trump wing of the capitalists realize that. And they're trying to orient to the global South. But to do that, they got to put this Ukraine nonsense to bed, you see. And then they got to pull financially out of Europe, which they're going to do. And the Europeans, of course, see this and they're panicking, right? Because now they got to raise their own industry, their own weapons industry, which is virtually non-existent, especially next generation technology weapons like AI and so forth. Europe's not even in the game when it comes to AI. 90% of all the AI patents are filed by the U.S. and China. So Europe is the backwater of technology right now. It's the backwater of banking. It's industry. It's industry development lags the U.S. In a whole number of ways, the U.S. is making Europe a dependency, an economic dependency, not just because of sanctions and blowing up, the Nord Stream thing, which made them dependent on U.S. gas and oil, but driving Russia out of the European economy altogether, in which American companies are flooding in the vacuum. But U.S. policies that have to do with taxes, even under Biden, tax policies were passed that's just sucking money capital out of Europe right now. And on top of that, we got the tariffs now, the tariff policies, right? And on top of that, you've got Europe saying we're going to remilitarize, we're going to develop weapons, we're going to spend $800 billion to develop a weapons industry, which is at the tip of the iceberg, by the way. Germany's going to spend $500 billion just on infrastructure, who knows how much more for weapons. So we have this massive weapon industrialization going on in Europe. But Europe can't produce the weapons at least for another 5 years. It takes that long to really develop these factories and this, you know, plus they're way behind in AI and will remain behind. So what's all this about? Well, the U.S. is going to pull out of Europe and the NATO bases and that wasted expenditure. But guess what? The Europeans are going to raise bonds and raise money. And where are they going to get the weapons in the meantime? From the U.S. But they're going to pay full market price now, you see. That's the difference. Well, to make Europe even more dependent on the U.S., you know, economically. You know, this whole war with Russia was really about debilitating the Russian economy and regime change. Well, that didn't work at all. In fact, quite the opposite happened. But it weakened Europe. And I kind of think that was always the plan B of the United States with this war anyway. Make Europe dependent on it. Drive Russia out of Europe altogether, not just out of energy, right? And make Europe dependent on U.S. industry and U.S. banks. And that's happening. That's happening as we speak. So the U.S. does not have to throw money at Europe anymore, does not want to. It needs to develop its own weapons industry even more. It needs to take care and consolidate the empire in the Western Hemisphere once more. And it needs to orient it toward taking care of its lake called the Pacific Ocean, you see. So that's what's happening. It's a restructuring a la 1980s economic restructuring, a la World War II, 1944, Bretton Woods, a la, 1917, 18. The empire goes through these periodic restructurings. It changes the mix of its economic policies. It forges new political institutions global. And that's how you must see what's going on. Now, the problem in the U.S. is the whole capitalist class is not united around that particular vision. You still got the old guard, the Democrats, and the huge bureaucracy that's blown up after 50 years in the U.S., of the empire neoliberalism, right? They're fighting back. They don't want to change anything. They wanted to keep everything the way it is. Well, you've got this domestic element of this restructuring, which is, well, we're going to cut costs to government and we're going to move it somewhere else. Right? Yeah. and the Democrats don't want to do that. They want to keep they are totally blind and terribly led and have no alternative to what's going on except no change. Keep it the same. And of course, the bureaucracy likes that because the bureaucracy, has done quite well. It's, really expanded over the last 40, 50 years. So you got this alliance between the Democrats and the old bureaucracy, and you got the, Trump, which is more than just MAGA now. They're all signed of a new coalition there, and they want to change things. And it's going to be a protracted fight here for some time to come.
Okay. Well, in case you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name's Michael Welch, and we're speaking right now with Jack Rasmus, who is a former teacher at the St. Mary's College, and he's a journalist, and he's the host of Alternative Visions. Jack Rasmus, in terms of this stage of restructuring, having to face new realities in the empire and so on and so forth, I have to also ask about restructuring for whom. I mean, when he was inaugurated, Donald Trump had 13 billionaires in his camp, including Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Elon Musk is a major player in his team. I remember Michelle Chossadovsky talking about how the COVID crisis was the excuse, he says deliberately planned, to engineer a broad economic depression, cancel millions of jobs, impoverish people with the lockdowns, and then appropriate and redistribute the wealth that remains among the wealthy. And according to a 2022 report by Oxfam International, while 263 million people could be pushed into extreme poverty that year, the world's billionaires saw their collective wealth go up by $12.7 trillion. That's up about 42% what they had during the pandemic. Now, effectively, it's like the 1929 stock market crash, right? Now, is this new restructuring of the U.S. economy actually being designed specifically for the status of the billionaire class in America in mind? I mean, make sure the Americans know who's really in charge in this new restructured America, in other words.
Well, you know, they certainly benefit from all this, and their interest pushing it means even more money for them. So you can't separate out the advantages and the benefits that flow to the very rich, the capitalists and the billionaires and the tech, you know, the new leading edge of capitalism. And you know, they lever it. They take advantage of it. And that's part of the deal to get it pushed through. You can't separate out their interests and the whole restructuring because, you know, they're the big beneficiaries of the whole thing. They make money when wars are started and they make money when wars are ended. And that's what's going on in Ukraine. You know, all this talk about minerals and everything. And the deal is really about how we're going to, quote, redevelop what's left of Ukraine and who's going to really get that money. Well, it's going to be the capitalists who get the money. Europe has its pot of money called the Russian assets, $300 billion, right? Well, the U.S. doesn't have a pot to pay its capitalists to redevelop Ukraine. That's what this $500 billion is about. Create a pot, right? Some of it will go to, U.S. capitalists who are already deeply entrenched in Ukraine, by the way, and they'll get that money. Just as the European capitalists will get some of the Russian money, right? That's how they make money off of ending wars, just as they make money off of starting them. So I don't think it's a question of either war or what came first. You know, the capitalists saying, you know, Peter Thiel and all those guys saying, well, we want you to do this, Trump. It's a very fluid thing where, you know, certain people for domestic reasons and for economic reasons and for foreign policy reasons sort of come together. Some of them may not even know of this bigger picture, but, you know, conditions push them along in that direction. As far as the COVID thing, they made a lot of money. The billionaires made a lot of money. That's documented. That's fact. Well, how did they make the money? Well, mostly they made it off of financial assets. Well, how did they get it off of financial assets? Well, the monetary policy was such that it gave them free money. You know, the Fed gave $4 trillion more to bankers and investors. They didn't need it because this, you know, the COVID thing wasn't like 2008 where you had the financial system collapse, where they threw $4 trillion to prevent the further collapse. No, the banks and the financial system was not in trouble in 2020, but they threw $4 trillion at them anyway. They took advantage of the crisis, you see, and stocks just blew right through the whole COVID thing. And in the last 2 years, stock markets are up, 50 to 65% just in 2 years, last 2 years. So, yeah, these policies are always benefiting the very wealthy, especially the finance capitalists and the technology companies and the energy companies, these leading edge of the capitalist class. You know, your local real estate guys aren't big players in all this, but the big capitalists always benefit from this. And yeah, they took advantage. I don't know if they told Trump, what to do here. It's kind of hard to make those connections, but it's obvious you got a huge smoking gun that the 2008-09 policies benefited them tremendously. The 2021 policies, in which, by the way, we spent $10 trillion. 2021, $6.7 trillion in fiscal stimulus, another $4 trillion in monetary stimulus, $10 trillion. And what did we get for the economy in the full 2 years that the economy was open, 22, 23, 24, we barely got 2% GDP growth. So we threw $10 trillion at the economy to get an average, historical average GDP growth, which means fiscal and monetary policy are broken in this country. That's part of the contradictions, you see, of neoliberalism. They're just not working anymore. But boy, are they funneling the wealth. both through monetary and fiscal policy, into the hands of the billionaires and all of them below them on the capitalist pyramid.
Okay, we only got about a minute left. Would you care to comment on the selection of Mark Carney as the new leader of the Liberal Party and you know, ultimately the new Prime Minister of Canada? I mean, he was a former Goldman Sachs banker and the governor of the Bank of Canada and the governor of Bank of England, and he reportedly directed the Canadian government on how to avoid the effects of the 2008-2009 financial crisis. On the tariffs from Donald Trump, Carney had said the following, I believe. He said that, he said he would go with the dollar for dollar tariffs and in effect, aim it at them with the worst, the least impact on Canadians. So do you think that this is the best strategy for avoiding or diminishing the effects of Donald Trump's tariffs?
Well, yeah, I see Carney as put in place there by the finance capitalists, who are not just Canadian finance capitalists, but, you know, finance capitalism just sort of breaches country boundaries, right?
Yeah.
They want a normal, quote, normal controlled change in the restructuring of the tariff and external policies. You know, Trudeau was just a big problem. Trudeau was just aggravating the hell out of Trump, and he was a big drag on trying to contain and control the whole process of the restructuring and tariff policy going on. Carney is a person who, you know, will work closely with his finance capitalist cousins in the U.S. and Canada and elsewhere, and they will try to bring some rationale to the whole process of what's going to happen with tariffs and other policies as well. So, you know, the capitalists see him as the right guy to sort of tame and control the whole process that's going to happen. Trudeau was just going to aggravate it. He was going to maybe take it out of control, you know, and cause, you know, extreme tit for tat. We saw the same exchange, with Ford and Trump, Ford, the Ontario guy there, saying, oh, we're going to put tariffs 25% on your electricity. So Trump just, bumps it up to 50%. You know, he sends a signal to him, you better get this guy out of the picture, right? let's talk with Carney and, there'll be a settlement. There will be some increase in what Canadians are going to have to pay with the tariffs, but it will be controlled. It will be kept in a reasonable range. And that's what I see Carney as the selection and what his role will be.
Dr. Rasmus, I've got to leave it there, but I really enjoyed discussing these issues with you. Thank you so much for being a guest on the Global Research NewsHour.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Dr. Jack Rasmus is a journalist, author, a playwright, and host for the radio show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network, which airs Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at prn.live.
You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.